So this meeting is being conducted in person at the engineering service section boardroom. I thought I was in the wrong meeting for a minute. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may also participate virtually by logging into the HC Zoom meeting. Any member of the public may listen to the meeting or make comments to the committee using the call-in number or Zoom webinar link. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public using either the call-in or the internet-based service, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meetings in person. A reminder to staff who are representing online, please mute all the devices until you're ready to speak. Make sure your cameras are on and you are unmuted. And when you are done with your item, please remute and turn off the camera. Members of the public may comment as to the items within the subject matter jurisdiction of the agency that are not on the agenda during item two. Members of the public wishing to comment on items covered in the agenda may do so at the time of each agenda item. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, when I announce the agenda item you wish to speak on, click raise your hand feature in Zoom. You will be notified when it is your turn to speak. Please unmute when requested. To participate in public comment via phone, when I announce the agenda item and you wish to speak, dial 9 to raise your hand. Phone participants will be called on by the last two digits of their phone number or by name. When it's your time to speak, dial 6 to unmute. Procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce the agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comment. I will ask for discussion and questions from the committee members. And the committee then comes to a consensus to move an item to board consideration. Any PowerPoint shown at tonight's meeting will be posted on the SCB Water website. So we're ready to move on. Director Amtage.
Yes.
Sorry. It's your turn. You've been elected to do the pleasure.
Oh, well, thank you. Please rise.
You didn't read my lips?
No. Please say, face the flag, place your right hand over your heart, and ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We need to get better, Brian. You got it. It's fantastic.
Getting everybody
drunk tonight. No alcohol. Just to start it, it's wonderful. So, I'm assuming the microphones are working okay.
Yes, they are.
Yes.
Okay. So, item two, public comment. Do we have any public comment? And the public comment is anything that's not on the agenda. We have anybody that's logged in?
We do, but we do not have public comment at this time.
Okay. Thank you very much. Item three, legislative consultants report. Going to start off with, looks like the presentation is going to Is Hunt coming first, or is that just up there for a reason?
That's good.
No, it'll be fast.
Okay. So, Mr. Bowman?
Thank you. It is good to see everybody again. It's been way too long since we've met. But again, thank you for having me here tonight. In addition to my written report, I've got four items to either extrapolate upon or that are in addition to the report. The big news this week was that the Environmental Protection Agency yesterday issued new health advisory levels for PFAS. The agency has updated its health advisory levels, lowering PFOA to 0.004 parts per trillion and PFOS to 0.02 parts per trillion. We've been currently working under a 2016 advisory that is 70 parts per trillion for either compound or a combination of both. I am not a scientist, but from what I understand, these may be analytically undetectable levels of PFAS. At the same time yesterday, EPA also announced it is inviting states to apply for $1 billion, the first of the $5 billion in the bipartisan infrastructure law grant funding to address PFAS and other emerging contaminants in drinking water. They're trying to steer these funds to smaller or disadvantaged communities. These funds will be administered to the states through the state revolving loan fund mechanism. The good news is that 100% of these funds are intended to be used for grants and loan forgiveness, not loans like the traditional SRF projects. Also, earlier this week, SCV Water worked through the Bureau of Reclamation Water Smart Program on a grant application. This would be for PFAS treatment for wells S6, S7, and S8, which is located along the Santa Clara River in the Bridgeport community. If we can get the funding for this, if you can operate the project at full capacity, it'll restore about a little over 9,600 acre feet of water a year. The estimated cost of the project, as I understand, is $14 million. SCV Water is applying to the Bureau of Reclamation for $5 million in grant funding. Again, the application was filed earlier this week. We're working with Congressman Garcia's office on obtaining a letter of support. We identified this as a potential opportunity early in the year, but it was Cheryl Fowler, Kathy Martin, and Steve Cole played a much bigger role in this application than I did. And in terms of FY 2023 funding, you know, Congress has gotten back into the business of earmarking to make it confusing. In the Senate, they call it congressionally directed spending. In the House, they call it community project funding. We had a good showing of the delegation for both Bouquet Canyon and for Arundo removal. Congressman Garcia and Senator Padilla requested $2 million to study the restoration of Bouquet Canyon. We should know, again, these are just the requests that the House members and the senators have made. We don't know if they made it into the bill that will be moved by the respective chambers. We should know the disposition of the House earmark request for Bouquet Canyon next week when they release the bills. It'll probably be later in the week, but the House subcommittees are marking up their bills next week, and then the full committee on the House Appropriations side will mark up their bills the following week in anticipation of bringing the House bills to the floor probably during the month of July. There are 12 bills that have to be enacted before the end of the fiscal year. I anticipate at least nine of the 12 bills will be moved through the House. I don't have a schedule for the Senate. That timing is very uncertain. In terms of Arundo removal, both Senators Padilla and Feinstein requested funding for Arundo removal, a little bit of a different flavor. You know, Senator Padilla requested $1 million. Senator Feinstein requested $500,000. This would be executed through the Corps of Engineers. Bouquet Canyon, pardon me, I should have mentioned that'll be executed through the United States Forest Service. Don't know the disposition yet on Arundo removal. May not know that until July, but should know something on the House side of Bouquet Canyon next week. This is a very difficult process in terms of the requirements that we were given to demonstrate local support. And the rules change every year. I really want to thank Steve and Kathy for bearing with us during this process. There was a lot of requirements related to getting letters of local support. I really, really want to thank Hunt Braley for running this down for us. I don't think we would have gotten as far as we did on these two earmark requests had it not been for those local letters of support. So, again, should know sort of the outcome next week. And then lastly on my agenda tonight, the House and Senate are working on the Water Resources Development Act of 2022. They thought this bill authorizes programs and activities for the Army Corps of Engineers. We looked at this bill as a potential way to have the Corps of Engineers engage in, you know, some of our local treatment and distribution projects. It's not a real natural fit for the Corps of Engineers, who has three main missions of navigation improvements, flood damage reduction, and aquatic ecosystem restoration. But the good news is that there is, in the House bill, which passed last week, there is $100 million Section 219 Environmental Infrastructure Authority, and SCV Water is listed as one of the two eligible participants for this $100 million. I got to be very careful. WERDA does not actually include any funding. As I sort of describe it, it is a license to fish. With the Corps of Engineers in Congress, it's kind of a two-part process. You first have to get the authority, then you have to go and chase the funding. Again, the House has passed its version of the bill. It includes the funding where SCV Water is listed as eligible. There's no timetable for the Senate. They've marked up their bill in committee, but in speaking to the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, there's no timetable to bring the bill to the floor. Wouldn't be the first time that Congress has enacted a bill where one of the two chambers hasn't gotten a bill through their respective process. It does make it a little more challenging. But if we get a law before the end of this calendar year, I think we can begin seeking funds for FY 2024, and that process begins in February of 2023. In terms of like how long this took, we started the process of seeking this authorization back in the middle part of 2020. And so it has taken some time just to get to this point. But again, really want to thank Congressman Garcia for spearheading this one. Again, not a natural fit for the Corps of Engineers, but they found a way to include it in the House version of WERDA. So with that, I'll close and happy to answer any questions you have for me tonight.
I believe I have a public comment card from Ken Hohmeyer on 3.1.
Yes, I had a question on the PFAS. I've been watching this for quite a while, and how much we've spent money on this. But I never, even in this report anywhere, tell me where it came from. Where's the main source of the PFAS? If you can tell me that, I'd be very interested in knowing. But it seems to me it's obvious, but they never say that. And then it's always the public's going to pay for this. Nobody's going to pay for it that actually did it. And this is getting a little tiring in this community that we always have that. And it comes out that it's coming out of our pockets. We pay for it. When I look at your agendas and I see, we'll just borrow some more money, add it to it. You have a huge debt already. Why is it that you never go after the source? And the source here should be pretty obvious. But I don't see one word from anybody about doing that. And if you can answer that and tell me the source, I'd be happy because I'm pretty sure what the source is.
Do you have any comments on the presentation that was just made in 3.1?
It wasn't that informative.
Okay. Meanwhile, you come and you ask pretty much the same question each time, and I direct you, as I usually do, you can get your answers from staff or from the general manager. This is public comment here. So anything else that you have to offer tonight?
It just tells me you don't know.
It doesn't tell you anything about we don't know. It's just the directions to go.
Okay.
I guess she's finished. So, committee, any questions, response?
Yeah, I was wondering if there was something that, why did they reevaluate the levels? Do you know why they reevaluated the PFAS levels in the EPA?
Great question. So this was something that the Biden administration had promised that they were going to go back and relook at the 2016 guidance. There was a what they call it a roadmap that the administration issued. I believe it was sometime in late 2021, which kind of laid out the very elongated process. And this was part of the process in terms of ratcheting down the levels of PFAS. I think that this is going to affect every municipal water district around the country, big and small. And so I think engaging with, I may be talking out of school a little bit, but I think engaging with our member associations like AQUA, NACWA, AMWA, on this, they know this is on their radar screen. I think in previous meetings, I've kind of suggested that the House and Senate were kind of leaning in a direction where they kind of wanted EPA to kind of take the first steps, and they were willing to be deferential to the agency on this. I think everybody was taken aback, but with yesterday's news, I mean, we found it. We were surprised.
It's not exactly ratcheting. It's like, it's a big jump. But I was wondering if they had done, I remember at one of our AQUA meetings going through the process of how they evaluate injury to the public and then establish a level. And it seemed to me that if they took that big a jump downward, that they may have found something that was really disturbing.
Yeah, I read some of the stuff on it. I think, the science continues to evolve, right? So they are continuing to evaluate new health, risk assessment and toxicological studies. And a lot of new information is coming in to the process that they have access now to that they didn't have access to before. I think, you bring up a good point. There's a process to regulation setting, right? And so this is the beginning, really, of that process. So they take a look and then they say, well, at these levels, we're confident that there's going to be zero health impact, right? So these are generally like the goals that you're familiar with, like a public health goal, maximum contaminant level goal. So they set those levels at levels that there's basically no observable health effect. So that's the beginning, kind of the first bar that's looked at. And then as you start going through the regulatory setting process to get to ultimately a maximum contaminant level, you go through a whole different set of analysis, of which part of it is the goal. Then you look at treatment technology and the feasibility of actually even treating to those levels. And then you also take into account cost at that point in time. And then that eventually promulgates what is known as the maximum contaminant level that kind of the industry or whoever needs to comply with those standards are held to. So kind of a first step in the process, it's interesting when you look at the levels. I mean, they clearly went a whole different level, right? So if you think about 0.004 parts per trillion, so that's 4 parts quadrillion.
So that means a lot of our wells are going to be closed.
So, well, it means you can't even sample down that flow yet. See, so that's where the technology component comes into this. So the laboratories can't even get down there yet.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I'll kind of leave the committee with, there's a long way to go in the process. There's going to have to be a lot of understanding on kind of parallel risk, I think, as a society, really. I'm talking about the big risk, right, of parts quadrillion versus other things that we do in our lifestyles that have influence on our health. And so I think as we're getting the technology to start finding these, constituents at levels that are so low, the toxicology is not refined enough to understand those interrelations between the health. So, it's a very interesting stage that we're in with this specific set of chemicals.
But you didn't hear that they did some testing and found that people get sick at much lower levels.
No, it's all the way the toxicology works, right? It's all extrapolation, right? So they do studies. Sometimes that can be kind of human exposure and what those studies have shown. But many times it's still the old techniques of, you know, testing lab animals at very high dosages, and you see what the response to those chemicals are, and then you extrapolate that down to what you think a human exposure would be to those chemicals and the results of that. There's a lot more to go. I mean, the toxicology thing on its own. And so you take one chemical and you do that. But toxicology is really difficult to understand when you're looking at multiple chemicals, right? And we really haven't got there as a science ability to do those yet.
Director Atkins.
Thank you. Jeff, good job. I'm going to pose a question to both you and Steve. You mentioned $2 million to Bokeh Canyon, a study. And we've looked at the stream morphology there, and we've more or less defined a process of restoration that if we could get our hands on $2 million, that whole stream could be recovered. There's a lot more agencies involved than we anticipated. So what the actual definition of a project is still being kind of decided. Is that true, Steve?
Yeah, I would look at this funding, the way it was approached, because there's also some state funding that is being sought for this.
Okay.
This is to get to a shovel-ready project. So it will define what the project is that will include restoration, right?
That's okay.
a key component of this whole endeavor. It's also going to include some major improvements to the road itself. In that area of the county, it's a lot of, you know, health safety issues from the road itself. And so this project is going to be the whole project. And so this money is to help get the project shovel ready. So you would get through environmental review, you would have defined plans and things. And
then
that ultimately would be what is sought for additional funding to build it.
Okay. So we're going to have to study it and get basically the paperwork in order, the permits ready and so on, basically get it ready. And to get from where we are to that green light is we think $2 million is going to cover that amount. And then through that process, we'll identify the scope of work necessary to fully restore. And whatever that dollar amount is, including public safety, is yet to be determined.
Yeah. The $2 million is a part of the getting it shovel ready. So you get through all that process, there's an estimate of roughly $9 million right now.
Okay, got it.
That's getting through design, you know, soup to nuts to get it to where you could go out and build it.
Okay, and what steps, and this is where it probably flips over to Jeff and Andy, in terms of the federal portion of this, what has to happen in order to make that $2 million real? What has to happen to get the other $7 million? In other words, how do we get this to be tangible dollars? That's my question.
Yeah, you can grab the $2 million one. You can articulate that. I can talk to the Wildlife Conservation Board one if you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, I think ideally you would like the $9 million in hand. You would like to get the whole $9 million. However, what we've noticed since Congress has returned to earmarking, there seems to be what I call a sweet spot in terms of what Congress is willing to do. I didn't see any opportunity for a $7-9 million community project funding request. It seemed like the sweet spot for this account for the Forest Service was in the neighborhood of $500,000 to $2 million. And so I think the short answer to this, Director Atkins, is it's a little arbitrary, but I think if we can get the $2 million and we can show demonstrable progress, I think for FY24-25, it makes the process a little less difficult. And they'll be, you know, the Forest Service, because they're providing the funds, they'll be more vested in this, as opposed to now where they're just kind of, you know, I think they're starting to pay a little more attention to this, but I think this will get, you know, if we can get this $2 million across the finish line, it may take a little while for the funding to hit the streets. I mean, we're still, frankly, in a lot of the 22 earmarks. You know, funds have still not been released by the agency, so it may take a little time, even if you get the appropriations bills done on time. But I think, you know, this is the first step. And if we can get over this hurdle, I think it makes things less difficult moving forward.
What I'm asking, though, is does it have to be approved by a committee? Is it simply an earmark? How does the $2 million become real?
Great question. So the process for this is the congressman has made the request. So has the senator. So next week, the Interior and EPA subcommittee will mark up their version of the bill. That's where they fund the Forest Service programs that we're targeting. So once they have to make the bill publicly available. They will then issue a report after the markup, and that report will include the tables of all the earmarks. The full committee in the House will then vote the following week on that bill. And then the House will bring that bill to the floor for consideration in July. The Senate process is identical to that. It's just they haven't released their schedule. Once both chambers have bills, they'll then meet in a conference or a negotiated settlement in which an identical bill will be produced that will have to then go back through each chamber. And then once it passes through both those chambers, it goes to the president for his signature. In an ideal scenario, Director Adkins, you would see that bill prior to the end of the fiscal year. For us, that's September the 30th. While the Interior EPA bill is a very popular bill, I don't think any of the 12 appropriations bills will get enacted before the end of the fiscal year. I think this is going to be done somewhere between Thanksgiving and New Year's 2023. I think that's when we'll get a final enacted Interior EPA bill. It may be packaged with other bills, but that's when we'll know for sure if the agency has the funding for this activity.
Okay. And you said the Senate was considering it. The Senate had some portion of this?
Yeah. So both the Senate and the House have their own, they have identical processes in terms of moving the bills through the committees and off their respective floors. The Senate has not set a timetable for their committee markups, which means they don't have a schedule for their floor consideration either. Typically, the Senate does move their bills in July, but last year they didn't move their bills until, I think, August at some point. And then we didn't get a final appropriations bill, I don't think, until March of this year, which was almost 6 months into the fiscal year. This is the new normal.
Okay.
We haven't, the last time Congress enacted all 12 appropriations bills on time was 1996.
Just as an aside, just for everyone's knowledge, last night there was a fire in Bokeh Canyon and it closed Bokeh Canyon Road. And I had the opportunity to go through there. And my hat is off to the National Forest. The Forest Service scrambled an L-1011, hundreds of guys. They were all lined up at night with their Minos hats on. And it looked to me as though somebody flipped a cigarette out their window, because the fire started at the roadside and went up right next to one of the 81 cabins that are in that canyon. And that's one of the benefits of this restoration, is it reduces fuel for wildfires. And groundwater sustainability and endangered species, the list is huge. The stakeholder list is growing as well. So I so appreciate the work you're doing on it, Jeff. I want to encourage you to keep doing it. And Steve, same thing. Thank you both, men, for all you're doing.
I'm just curious, who's the we that did the fluvial study? We did a fluvial study? Did the water agency?
No. I didn't say a fluvial study. What I said was, the morphology of the stream would change if you simply do some of the manual restoration we talked about. I didn't say fluvial. Sorry.
Any other comments?
Yes. Great. Thank you. So two sets of questions. One, I want to go back to the issue of PFAS. So
you hear her okay, Jeff?
Yeah, thank you. Thanks. So specific to our agency, we, I think 3 months ago or so, received a notification letter on one of the wells having PFAS levels that were above notification level, but below response level. And my understanding is that that water is being blended to dilute it so that it's not unsafe, as in terms of what we understood before to be unsafe. So I'm wondering, is based on what was released yesterday by the EPA, and assuming we have enough water, are there any thoughts changing in terms of keeping that well up and running?
I think at this point in time, probably not, because we're still subject to the California regulations. And so I think what we're looking for is, what is California going to do with this new set of information that they have available? So that's kind of the natural flow of the process on how the regulatory structure works. So okay. I think that's what you'll see our agency doing, is looking to California and the regulatory community and how they are going to treat the information.
Okay. And I guess in terms of timeline, I guess it should have been more specific. Are we going to be proactive and maybe take that out of line, again, assuming we have other sources that can meet demand? Or are we going to keep that up until we are told what we need to do with that?
I think the plan right now is to continue to operate the wells that we have that are meeting the current standards for the state of California.
Okay, because I mean, I'm just going to say that I, without having seen any of the data behind yesterday's announcement, I just feel like if they have taken that drastic of a drop in their health advisories, that there is something concerning behind that. And I've always appreciated the very proactive stance that the agency has taken in terms of keeping an eye on PFAS levels and PFAS exposures to our customers and ratepayers. So, I just feel like if there's a way that we can still meet demand without putting that water into the distribution system, I think that would be great. But I don't know all the details behind it. So, but maybe that's something we can look into.
Okay. Thank you for the input, for sure.
Yeah. I would just add, it just came out, so we are evaluating it, but I want to be clear. These are not regulatory limits from the federal side either. So just as in California, we have the notification level, the response level, and in some cases, public health goals. Those are not the regulatory limits. We use the response level as kind of our trigger, because the alternative would be to continue to serve water and write fairly extensive notifications and or letters to our customers. And we feel that's probably a fairly, in the absence of an MCL, it's a fairly good benchmark to try to achieve. For these HA levels from the federal government, they are basically the theoretical zero point where there is no risk, whereas an MCL accepts a certain amount of risk over a lifetime of so many, occurrences in a million, just as we do with risk in all kinds of other areas: auto safety, aircraft safety, food safety. And so the challenge for us would be, if we treated the HAs as the point at which we shut off our wells, we would have no wells operating anywhere, I would guess, at least those that are impacted by PFAS. There may be other HA levels for other contaminants that are well below the MCLs, and we operate through the MCLs.
Got it. Thank you. And then my second question is, first of all, I didn't say thank you to Mr. Bowman for your written report and your verbal report. As always, I appreciated it. Thank you. My second question was related to, there's mention on the second page of your report at the very bottom, grant funding to assist publicly owned treatment works in implementing PFAS legislation as well. And I think I may have asked this question in the past, so I'm sorry if it's a repeat. I just want to make sure LA County Sanitation District, are they looped into this? Do they have someone like you, Mr. Bowman, advocating for them and looking for funding for what their portion of PFAS control?
The first threshold matter to address, Director Armitage, is this is just an introduced bill. It hasn't actually gone anywhere yet. It hasn't been enacted. So this is all sort of a kind of in the ether of a lot of bills that get introduced. Sometimes they get enacted. More often than not, bills don't. There's thousands of bills that never get enacted every year. So I would presume that Los Angeles County and a lot of its municipalities have folks like myself. And what I would say is that, as I understand the calculation, there are 15,000 lobbyists and more than 3,500 firms that do just what I do. So I would imagine that they have some level of expertise that handles this. I don't know off the top of my head who this is. All I can tell you is that based on that amount of sort of talent that's out there, thank you for choosing Vanscoyuc Associates to represent you, because it's a fiercely competitive environment. So I believe that they've got an established, you know, reputable firm or firms in Washington, D.C. that are flagging this. I just don't know off the top of my head who that is.
Okay. I just, as a follow-up then, I just wonder if it would be wise of us to find out who those counterparts are and making sure that they are, if this becomes a bill and that money becomes available to them, that we know who those people or person is. So we could be like, heads up, there's some money on, you know, available to you guys to do your part for PFAS removal on the sanitation side. So,
yeah, I think we definitely can do that. We, just so the committee is aware, we do have an active staff meeting with the SAN district every other Friday. So, and that's basically their top level management. So we are talking about these things. It'd be easy to have that communication happen. I know they have representatives as well as staff members that just do advocacy. So they actually have internal staff members that are doing a lot of advocacy as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any additional comments? So moving on to item 3.2. Dennis Ariani.
Thank you, Jeff. So good evening. I keep freezing, so if that occurs, I'll just restart my video. That's what I figured out works, but I don't know why this is occurring, because I'm at home where we have good Wi-Fi. But thank you very much for the opportunity to come. Anthony and I are right now, this is kind of the hot spot of California legislative process, as well as the budget process. So yesterday, and I'll let Anthony talk about the specifics, but yesterday at 2:30, they delivered a budget of over $300 billion to the governor. And again, he'll go through specifics, but I'll just kind of do the general thing, is that this is really what has become a constitutional budget. You say, well, what's that mean? Some people call it a two-party budget. So the Senate and the Assembly have essentially agreed on the macro elements of it. And then they're sending that to the governor. And that's to meet the constitutional deadline of June 15th. The governor will very likely read through it. We'll have some quiet talks behind. He'll sign this document very likely. And then over July, maybe even the next 10 days, but really over July, they'll talk about it. And then when we come back in August, there will likely be a series of budget trailer bills, or what we call, you know, baby budgets, that put specificity to those requirements and those programs and those allocations. So that process used to be, you know, we'd sit in summer and it'd go when it was a two-thirds vote and you'd argue these things out. But now they make sure they meet the requirements, have a macro budget, and then work on the programs as they go and as they can get agreement. And so it's a different process. It's been, you know, the last 4 or 5 years, this is how they've done it. They don't even have a conference committee where they bring the budgets together and have some open items where they negotiate public. This is all done now. And then, you know, they vote one day in the budget. And frankly, it took 20 minutes of discussion on the floor. It used to be 4 or 5 hours, 20 minutes of the assembly, 20 minutes of Senate, bam, vote, and move the budget through. So it's really a, I don't want to overstate the shell, but it's really a, it lacks the specificity that will come later as we work over July and within August parameters. And then the legislative session ends August 31st by constitution this year. And so, you know, everything will be buttoned up for sure by August 31st. I'll let Anthony talk more specifics, but let me go through a couple of the bills. So, and where we are. So we are now in the second house, second policy committee, or first or second policy committee, for bills that were both introduced this year and have gone through the House of Introduction and then now are getting their hearing in the second house, but also a lot of bills that were held over and either held in the second house or moved, were two-year bills and moved early this year. All those bills are now being heard in the second house. So it's quite busy right now. If anybody hasn't come up, and we invite you up when now that kind of some of the things of the pandemic are starting to calm down a little bit. They have moved out of the Capitol essentially with all their offices. They're at what's called the swing space. So a lot of hearings go there. And then there's a few hearings that occur in the historical side of the Capitol and in some of those few meeting rooms that exist there and the floor, frankly. So they still do floor at the old Capitol. So a lot of things are happening kind of different times. Then that's frankly how we're going to do it for probably four or five years is they'll be in the swing space and just using the Capitol for floor and a few hearings. But that's the physical issues. Some of the issues that have been coming up and that's going, and I'll start with one of them that's fairly controversial. Hertzberg has a bill, SB 1157, on indoor residential water use. It would regulate water use down to, and by 2025, 47 gallons per resident for residential household, and in 2030, 42 gallons. And so this is a discussion item that's been ongoing. And, you know, Aqua has an opposed position on that. They have been engaged with that. We've been watching it and following the discussions. And that bill, there's a lot of, you know, conversation. They really haven't got to negotiations yet, but that's an ongoing conversation about what would be appropriate. I think there's kind of some different levels of discussion. One is, you know, obviously we're in a drought. Obviously, you know, the governor has emergency orders and he's pushing down that is kind of a macro per district, you know, way, the best way to control that. Or do we actually go down from the state to the micro, you know, household and do that? And so that's an ongoing conversation, kind of more of a policy conversation. The second part of it is really, you know, local control. You all are elected local officials. They're elected in Irvine, they're elected in Sacramento, and there might be different needs and different hydrology and all that in different places. And is it appropriate to do a you know, that level of detailed regulation from the state down? So those are some of the dialogue going on. And then finally, they're still reviewing the DWR study and that, you know, and getting that finalized. It hasn't been yet. So that's one of the things that occur. Apologize again. There we go. Got it back. Sorry. So that bill 1157. Then there's another bill, 1020. That's significant to the state water contractors. And what that does is it accelerates the SB 100 requirements, which was written carbon free energy from 100% 2025 to require agencies to of the state, and that would be DWR and how they run the state water project, to accelerate to 2035 their the purchases, and even some 2030. And so it kind of regulates that. Was on a call today coordinated by state water contractors with DWR. I think they have some concerns, for lack of a better term, but about how it's written, how that could affect the state water project. So they're asking for some amendments. The DWR has it tagged at $3.3 billion in increased costs to local, to the state water contractors, and then passed on to each individual agency proportionally. So that's a concern, obviously, $3.3 billion increased cost. There's a couple elements in it, and I'll get into a little detail. So that $2.6 billion is just the policy behind the bill. But they also had some provisions in there about the energy had to be from in front of the meter, meaning that it has to be in state and some other requirements on that. And that was to promote local and California jobs so that the labor unions have been engaged with this. So that requirement itself required they had tagged, DWR had tagged a $600 million increase. So if you could fix that, and we've been negotiating with the Pro Tem's office and the staff, and it looks like there's going to be an agreement there. So that would lower the price tag from $3.3 billion by $600 million. And then there's another $100 million in a contract that the state, that the DWR entered into for a Lodi power plant that they're obligated to do on, and it's a gas plant. It's a fairly clean plant, but still burning gas, natural gas. And that contract goes past that date, and they take that as $100 million. So if they can deal with what's called the Lodi issue, because that's where the power plant's located, then either exempt it or deal with that, that would remove $100 million of the costs. So that would get down to essentially a $2.6 billion policy if this is enacted, that would accelerate those costs and having to get there. And then there's a few other things, like making sure there's a firewall on any other procurements, because they have DWR as the expert procuring all the energy for the state, other agencies, not the entire state, but other agencies. And so, if something goes bad in one of those contracts, we don't want it to wash out onto the state water contractor. So there's some of those very constructive dialogue that we've been involved in with, again, the Pro Tem's office, with DWR, and trying to figure out how to do this in a way that would minimize cost to ratepayers, if that's really what the policy of the legislature and the administration is. And so that's been a lot of time, a lot of focus, good conversations. And that's moving that forward. But just wanted to update you on that. Then I know, and in fact, we have things are moving so quickly that they called a special Aqua State Legislative Committee on Monday to discuss that bill being one of them, the 1157 indoor water use bill, and then another bill on 1205 by Senator Allen, which I think is all worked out. He changed it on water measurement, and having the water board do water measurement. So those three bills, because Aqua has positions on them, they need to have a state legislative committee to discuss with the folks and do that. And so we'll be working with staff, Steve and Kathy, on the directive that they give, and we go. But I really wanted to go through those three bills, really the two bills, and that, because they, you may read about them in the paper. There's Aqua positions, and we're engaging constructively on all those. Then I know there's always a question about 222, and ratepayer assistance. That bill, so we got a note, and I wrote a note to the author as well, but that they're planning on taking that bill off of inactive for the purpose to amend it, but still hold it till August. And some of the amendments that they're going through, the biggest one and the most important is they're narrowing it down. They used to have it couple different agencies, public health and that. They're going to put all at the water board in their clean water section. And which frankly, I think makes sense, but it would be one entity instead of having several different entities. There is still not a funding source. They have not identified a funding source. They're working through that. And in talking with the staff person, Les Spahn, they are going to they're going to work through July and continue to do that. And he said he'll keep us in informed and welcomes any thoughts we have on 222. And I have articulated them, said, hey, look, you know, generally, as long as it's there's a funding source, you know, how do we make this work? We want to be constructive, and that's appreciated. So those are really several of the bills that are a lot of activity on, and that there's and that is moving through. Glad I'd like to kick it to Anthony now to talk quickly about the budget and some of the key things. We've had meetings even with Bloom this week and continue that. So Anthony.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Dennis. And it's great to see you all. It feels like it's been a long time since we've all met and been able to have a conversation and discussion on these priorities. So Dennis did an excellent job going over the budget and giving a nice picture of where we're at right now. But I'm going to take it a brief step back to the May revision that the governor proposed. And as Dennis mentioned, it was massive this year. Historic, again, $300 billion budget with the budget surplus of $97.5 billion. Prior to this, we were hearing rumors that it was going to be about $60 billion. So astronomical change on the day that the budget was released for the May revise. The state's fiscal footing is still doing excellent. They're at about a $37 billion budgetary reserve. So no issues there. The governor and his May revise had key priorities that he really sustained from his January budget. But I'll tell you, one of the main sticking points was the rising inflation, which we'll get into in a moment. But public safety, housing and homelessness, climate change, education, all of those stayed as his primary topics that he addressed in his May revision, adding a lot of extra funding out of those topics. What's key for Santa Clarita Valley Water Agency for the water and drought resiliency portion of the budget that the governor proposed. If you know, last year, he did a $5 billion investment in water and drought. In January, he added $750 million to this purpose. But then in May, he went a large step further and actually went up to $1.3 billion additional dollars. So it brings that to a total of roughly $2 billion more that the governor is going to invest specifically. One thing of importance that we wanted to note and mention is in this portfolio package that the governor put out, he did $530 million to support water recycling, groundwater cleanup, clean water projects, which we know is important to the water district. But what we have done, just seeing that as a big bucket of money, we have been pushing for specifically to get a line item to up the PFAS funding support that was done in last year's budget. We have been meeting with the different budget chairs, as Dennis mentioned. We were with Assemblymember Bloom this week. We've met with Senate Budget Chair Wieckowski a couple weeks back on this issue and made sure he knew that we were going to move forward on continuing to advocate to have this specific funding go towards PFAS and not just in a larger bucket of groundwater cleanup money. We've also testified in all the budget subcommittees as the May revision was rolled out. That being said, leading us to where Dennis started off tonight, there was a joint budget agreement announced a week or so ago between the legislative leaders of both houses, largely similar in the amount of money that's spent with the budgetary reserves moving forward. I will say in our conversations this week, what we have learned, as Dennis mentioned, the budget was passed largely as a framework, which allows legislators to continue to be paid since they met their constitutional deadline. But right now, their main focus that are sticking points from what we got directly from the budget subconsultant and their office directly is they're working on zero emission vehicles, energy, high speed rail, and then the drought. Those are their four primary points of discussion at the moment right now. We did bring up PFAS to them again, just to keep it top of mind for those folks as they go into those negotiations. Moving forward, the real big point of contention right now between the big three, the governor, the pro tem, and the assembly speaker, in their negotiations, is how to get money back to families here in the state of California. As Dennis mentioned, the budget was passed, but this is one of the negotiating points. I think that we will likely see a decision made before legislators go on break for spring recess. The governor wanted to do this in a gas relief plan based on families with vehicles, and the legislature was not okay with that. They feel like everybody should get relief from what's going on with rising costs of inflation, and they want to base it off family income and dependents within households. So really, that's a major point of contention. I believe that the governor is going to use the budget that was passed as a little bit of leverage to help him strike a deal on this issue. And when we see that, we'll likely see the budget and that be signed pretty close to each other. Again, it could go out farther, but that's just my analysis of the situation. With that, happy to take any questions related to the budget moving forward.
And just one more quick thing. Well, two more, actually. And while all this is going on, there has been an election. So there's a primary election that was out. I think you all know, you know, the various outcomes. Glad to discuss when appropriate. But, you know, your area continues to be a high area of interest, both, Assembly, Senate, and in Congress. But then finally, there was also, you probably all have read, because we needed to confuse things even more, we had a speakership battle that is still, to be honest with you, ongoing. And, you know, winner, loser, who knows, that we can all analyze how that went out. But what it is doing, and it's good to know, is politically, there is significant uncomfortableness in the caucus, significant confrontation at times in the caucus and in the Assembly Democrat caucus. And that's while, you know, for us who do this, you know, we take note on where everybody is. And so bills go up if they're in one side of it and it's and that chair is from the other camp. There are those dynamics playing out daily and tempers getting a little bit hotter. And it's really interesting to watch. Speakership battles and leadership battles are very rare. You know, they're every 5-6 years, but this one playing out is very interesting to watch from us. And actually, it's part of our, you know, we're calculus. We have to take into the calculation where everybody was, where each bill is, because sometimes it flares up, and for some reason this bill dies or gets. They revived a few bills to try to get more votes for the speaker. I mean, it's been interesting dynamics going on. So that's where we talk about it, but I may just turn off my video altogether.
Well, I don't understand how you can be freezing in Sacramento. It must be over 100 up there.
Fair enough. Now we'd be open for questions if you have any. Glad to do that.
I have no speaker cards on this subject, 3.2. Any questions from the directors?
Steve, you talked about, I'm sorry, I sound like a broken drum, but it's 2 to 7 million. What portion of that would come from the state? And how
so right now, the county and a broader stakeholder group is working with California Department of Fish and Wildlife on a wildlife conservation board grant. And right now, the request is in for the full amount of funding on that side. So we're looking to have the federal component come in and provide, you know, kind of a balance so that there's skin in the game from the federal side and the state side. So it wouldn't be, you know, 7 plus 2, for example, to land at the right place. It would be, you know, if the Wildlife Conservation Board funds
whatever that
6
is,
the federal piece could fund the difference. And so you could,
so we're trying to get 9, and we're, however it works between the state, the state's going
to
come up with.
Yeah, and there will be need to be some local funds in the game too, I'm guessing. That's usually the way these things work. So,
okay.
But right now, the application is in for that full amount on the Wildlife Conservation Board grant.
Well, what would be the source of local funds, in your opinion?
Well, I think they could be a few different things. You could look at Measure W funds,
okay.
Right? So it's a project that the county wanted to sponsor. Through that process, several of us, several of us that have been in that process, I think, would like to see a project like that. So I have talked to the county about that a little bit, but it's going to need a little bit more urgency put on it for that. Or we could wait to access those funds to do the actual project too.
Okay.
So there's a few different things. I know the county does have some funds set aside through flood control to move the project along. So that's another source of funding that's available.
And have you, I know you've talked with Dennis and Anthony about this. Is there anything they should be doing with Fish and Wildlife or any other agency or any other legislator that?
Yeah, I think right now, because the big benefit of this one is because California Fish and Wildlife is so fully engaged on this project now.
Okay.
That piece of advocacy is extremely valuable, and that's the one that they are leading that access into the Wildlife Conservation Board funding.
Fish and Wildlife is. Okay, so you got any friends with Fish and Wildlife, Dennis? Hello, Dennis.
Sorry. We do actually, have relationships, obviously, from the director and the Wildlife Conservation Board, which is staffed by Fish and Game staff. And yes, and Steve and I and Kathy and Anthony have discussed that, and the strategy is actually to work it through the regional staff there locally and then up. And so that's how that's been happening. Okay. Yes, right. When we need to call, we can call the director as well.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Additional questions?
Thank you. So I have four sets of questions and one comment to close with. So first, I noticed there was a discrepancy in a couple of the positions listed for bills between the summary report and the legislative status report. So I just wanted to get clarification on which one was correct. So for Assemblyman Gabriel's AB 2142 on the turf replacement exemption, it's listed as a watch, I think, in the summary and a support in the thicker document. Where are our support on that, correct?
Yes. Go ahead, Anthony. You.
Yes, that is correct. And I testified in support on behalf of Santa Clarita Valley Watering Committee yesterday, actually.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. And then for Dodd's SB 222, one listed as opposed unless amend and one listed as a watch. I think we're a watch, right?
Well, we're still officially, because the bill has not changed. It's still on inactive. It actually is still on inactive right now, even though Les said he was going to. When that comes off, we could change our position. Well, we could change our position in time. But right now, officially, we are still on the opposed unless amended, as the bill hasn't changed and hasn't moved.
Okay, thank you. And then I know I've mentioned a couple times, and there was discussion, and I think there was concurrence on expressing support for Assembly Member Rubios's AB 2449 on open meetings. It is listed as a watch. Is there not going to be support for that then?
One second, I'm looking.
I think that's the one that's not moving, correct, Anthony? That's what a section.
That was in Senate rules pending referral. It was actually just amended today from what I saw. So those amendments need to be reviewed. And then I am not positive if we've switched positions yet. I'd have to look that up.
Okay.
Yes.
I personally would still like to support that. I don't know how the rest of the committee feels. I don't want to say we in this instance, because I don't want to assume that everybody else feels the same way.
Refresh our memory. What are the salient points of the bill? What's the bill number first?
AB 2449.
Okay. And the salient points? There's only a couple thousand. No.
It's on page 42.
Page 40, 48 on the PDF. But, yeah.
and you're supporting it, you're suggesting we support it.
Yeah, I feel like it just creates more transparency. I don't see a reason why, I don't see a negative. I don't see a reason why we should be against it. I just always think more transparency is better for the public.
Anthony or Dennis, can you kind of walk through what the debate's over right now?
Well, there was another bill moving that was, and I'm trying to find that, but this is all on local government and how you can do both in the future, post-COVID, how do we do meetings and posting and yeah. and hybrid meetings and all those kinds of things. And so, and there was another bill moving.
One that addressed state meetings, right? That yes. I felt like made it easier for people like from agencies like ours to be able to participate remotely rather than traveling to Sacramento. But I don't see that on here anymore, so I assumed it came off.
Yes, I think it did come off probably because it was held in appropriations. I could go back and reference a previous report and I'd be able to give you an update on that, Director Armitage.
Okay, but for 2449, like for instance, one difference I think from reading this is that each teleconference location to be identified in the notice and agenda and that each teleconference location be accessible. Wait, that's not, hold on, that wasn't what I was trying to point out, I think. I felt, tell me if I'm wrong, it felt like it made it easier where you don't have to necessarily list every single place that if somebody that's participating remotely would have to be, right? I felt like it made it easier to adhere to the Brown Act, but still allow board members to participate.
That is, that's the goal of the various meetings. They don't want, like if somebody's in a hotel or they were at their house, they don't have to necessarily have public people
right.
in your house right. meeting. I didn't mean that sounds funny, but that's where it's going. There is some, there's some back and forth on what level is appropriate of noting and transparency. And so, and I actually talked to Rubio's office about a month ago about this. But I will check up on that. And Anthony kind of has been following this area and we can send the update to Steve and Kathy in the next day or two.
Okay. Thank you.
Has Aqua taken a position on it?
Not positive. I can get that information over to you as well when we send the note to Steve and Kathy. And they amended the bill recently. I know that I saw it come across in an email notification that I received. So they may have a position and they may be repositioning given the amendments.
Okay.
Repeat that.
Like I said, I have the state ledge committee on Monday and I will bring that forward and ask about it as well.
What was the last thing you said, Anthony?
I said, given that it was amended yesterday and went into print today, they're likely going to be re-reviewing it. I don't know if they will change their position at Aqua or not, but they'll re-discuss the bill given the amendments that were.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you. I as I was reading the material and seeing that some of the positions weren't changed based on conversations that we've had in the past, I have to say I feel a little frustration. And so I took a step back because I thought, well, maybe my expectations are off. So I just wanted to ask that how much weight does the input that we give here at this committee have ultimately in how a bill gets listed in terms of support? Because I know it's not just us. I know that you factor in whether or not Aqua supports it or other water organizations support it. I know you talk to people, with Regenerate leadership on these bills. So, to be honest, I feel like sometimes the discussions that we have here don't really go anywhere because maybe it's not the same as what Aqua is saying or taking a position on. So I think I just need to have a better understanding of how much weight do our comments and our requests for consideration on positions matter?
Yeah, I think, I'll answer that one. Okay. And Dennis can can follow up. I mean, they have a huge amount of weight. So, I mean, I think that's what we're trying to do is understand a consensus. And maybe that's where it broke down a little bit the last time. I don't know that we had consensus. We had kind of input, okay, right, between from a few different directors in different ways. And so I think we're going to have to do a better job of when there's, you know, a preference to take a position that we hear from the full committee about whether the committee wants to go to that position.
And
depending on, I think, you know, potentially the level of controversy on some of the items, it may need to go to the board. You know, if the committee can't reach a consensus on, you know, preferred position, for example, may have to take it to another step in the process. But yeah, I mean, I think ultimately we are looking at, you know, a lot of the different inputs, but, you know, this is our agency, it's our position. And so as the policy makers of this agency, you do have a lot of input to provide in that. So I would say that let's just do a better job of, you know, like we are tonight on the 2449, we've heard it, we're going to get some feedback, let's get that, and then we can hear from, you know, all the committee members if they're in favor of moving forward with that position, and then we'll do that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for clarifying that, because I felt like that's been lost a little bit.
Yeah, certainly, I think we just haven't done a good job of kind of resolving the full committee's position, okay, as we're discussing it, so let's make sure we do that going forward.
Okay, thank you. And then continuing down my list, thank you for mentioning SB 222, because you know I'm going to ask for it probably. So I appreciate that. I will say I'm disappointed at the inability to make progress on finding the funding for this. And I know it's not just you all. I know this is kind of the big world of policy. But I do feel like we're being very passive at this. I am newer to this committee, so I've been learning for the past year and a half. So maybe I don't have, maybe I haven't seen as much of the history as the others. But I just don't understand why we're not strongly supporting this, because I feel like this only benefits water agencies. You know, it's making it so that not all of the, I don't know how many water agencies are in the state of California, have to go through this process and streamlining it. So I don't understand why there isn't the support that I just, in my head, I think there should be. So I'll just leave that at that. Let's see, on page 7 of the summary report, I had a question. You mentioned in the May revise, there's $1.2 billion to address residential electric utility arrearages. And then the May rate also includes $200 million to address residential water and wastewater arrearages as well. The question I have is, I know we've taken advantage of funding that was related to COVID relief funding that was part of the California Water and Wastewater Arrearage Program that helped significantly pay off some of the debt for the agency. So my question is this new money that the agency can go after to take care of perhaps of more debt that is on the books?
Yes, this would be new money.
Okay.
I'm not on mute. That is not a significant amount of that money was frankly federal funds that came through and was passed through. And there's a whole program with that. And we worked with Kathy and with Steve to identify those. This money would be a state money and would run through that process.
Awesome. Good to know. I'm assuming we'll keep on top of how to tap into that, right?
Good. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. 100%. And I think there is conversation, and it was alluded to when I communicated with Les, that this two, and this is what happens quite often, just, and again, you know, if it happens with 222, that we know it, but when policy is in the budget, I mean, some money's in the budget, and there's no direction at this point, often they could do their own bill and put it in the trailer bill. Or if somebody's been working on this, as Mr. Dodd has, a lot of times that bill might become the the vehicle to have all the allocation on how they want to do it. So they kind of agreed the State Water Use Control Board is the right one. Now they could put the, I'm going to say, the guts into it to direct that to go. And so that's what was alluded to. He didn't say, you know, an author never wants to say, yeah, my bill is going to be the one until it's a fully agreement. But that's what they're positioning it to be, was what I had picked up from Les doing this a long time. Les is a very experienced staff member.
Okay, thanks. And then the last thing I'll just say, it's just a comment. And I'm going to pass this on to you, Mr. Cole. So the in case SB 222 doesn't pan out and the board decides we do want to pursue a customer assistance program, this Sierra Club Water Sentinels just released a program where they select certain water agencies to work with to identify appropriate agencies in the community or around the community that can help establish a customer assistance program specifically for water utilities. I don't know if they'd be targeting like low-income areas. I imagine that's probably the direction they're going to go, but it doesn't say that in what I've kind of quickly read so far. So I figure it's not going to hurt to pass it on to you so that you're aware of it. So I will leave this for you after the meeting then.
Great. Thank you.
And that's all. Thank you.
Mr. Planbeck, I'd ask if you had any questions, but direct or amortized to your time.
Well, she asked great questions that I wouldn't take you.
A lot of good questions, Director Amitai. So nothing for you, Director Planbeck?
No, I'm good.
All right. So, and there was no online public comments. So on item 3.3, Mr. Rowley.
Thank you, members of the committee. Let me highlight a few things. First of all, as you've noticed from the last couple, and of course we didn't have a report from May, we didn't have a meeting, so this combines April and May. The Safe Clean Water Program has not met for the last 3 months, did not meet in June either. I did finally receive notification we're meeting on July 7th. It will still be a virtual meeting. They had sent out some information trying to organize an in-person meeting. Not clear why that has not occurred, but July 7th will be the next meeting. Don't know the agenda yet, and that will be in the virtual. As far as the city council is concerned, a couple major items I think we talked about some of these in April because it was after the first city council meeting. California Voting Rights Act has been, lawsuit has been settled. Two seats will be up in 2024 going to districts. The other three seats in 2026, those would basically be the three seats that are on this November ballot. There will be a public process where the public will be engaged on inputting on where they think the district should be. I believe the city will use one of the mapping services that local governments use to come up with the districts. The plaintiff's attorney had proposed districts. I do not know whether or not they will be part of the base for this. It does not indicate that that was part of the settlement. And the attorney received about $350,000, some of which does go to the plaintiff. You know, the public comments continue to be similar on many of the issues. The roundtable, the human relations roundtable, the Gascon recall, which the city has taken a specific support for. An update on that for those who are interested. They have to submit all their petitions or their signatures by July 6th. It was announced today they had received enough signatures, which was the amount required, which was like 560,000. However, they would need, in my opinion, in most people's opinion, probably 150,000 to 200,000 more signatures than that, because you're going to have invalid signatures. You're going to have people who don't live in LA County, you could have people who signed more than once. So that's a significant issue that will be coming up with us as well. City has adopted a revision of the downtown Newhall specific plan, an ongoing effort. And if you're downtown Newhall at all, you see a lot of construction activity that is going on there. City's made changes to the approval of the Sand Canyon Plaza project, which is an old mobile home project at Soledad and Sand Canyon, that just changes when commercial has to go forward. The city is also proceeding with its plans on the housing element and safety element. One of the interesting things on that is HCD is being much more, what's the word I'm thinking of, persistent on these programs. It used to be you adopted and sent up the HCD and it kind of went into a closet. There was very little activity. Now they're pushing back a lot on whether or not you're meeting those requirements. One of the things that came out of the adoption of the housing element was that the city has agreed to look at both inclusionary zoning and affordable housing density bonus credits, which are used by other jurisdictions, no later than 2024, which is the first time, especially on inclusionary zoning, that that has ever happened. And then let me just highlight that even though it's not in the written report, we did just have the city council election last Tuesday, and not election, I meant council meeting. And at that meeting, a couple of major things happened. The city passed its first almost $300 billion budget. I think it was $299 million, including significant, almost $80 million in a capital improvement program, still retaining its $19 million rainy day fund, and dealing with the projected increases that they expect. The history of the city's budget is very conservative, and even though some members of the public raised concerns about upcoming recession, the city manager made it clear that he thinks this is a conservative budget, and it's likely to be even better. And then the city also decided to award its new waste hauler contract. City had gone out to an RFP, as you may know. Waste management has been doing the residential, and the commercial has been done by Vertec for the last 20 years. The city put both out to bid, three companies, Athens Waste Management and Vertec, responded, and the city staff did their evaluation, awarded it to Vertec based on their evaluation, somewhat significantly, really significantly over Waste Management, a little bit over Athens. And that matter passed fairly non-controversial, and the new agreements will go on July 1st, 2023. Dealing with a lot of new state laws, one of the ones that will affect all of us is the organic waste, the food waste recycling, which is to be mandated in this new program. Will, when it goes into effect on July 1st, 2023, we'll have a robust food waste recycling portion. As far as elections, I know Dennis talked about that as well. On a local basis, turnout was very low throughout the state, although lots of ballots keep on coming in, so it may creep back up to about 30%. As far as LA County, there was a supervisor's race, which will go to runoff. Senator Stern, who represents part of the valley, was in that race, but he did not make the two runoff. And Senator Hertzberg is probably, certainly he's favored in that runoff, since he represents a lot of the San Fernando Valley where that district is. So I think that's it for now. Open, obviously, to any questions.
We have no public speaking card on this. Do we have any public on the internet?
We do not have public.
Any comments, Director Leavitt?
Yeah, I just have a little addition to Hunt's report on the safe clean water. They did have a meeting today, not the committee here, but the oversight committee, and they passed the Santa Clara River SAP. But what was even more interesting was that a lot of people discussed making water supply more of a component of it, particularly because we're in a drought. And I bring that up for your idea with the Measure W, okay. And it was many members of the oversight committee that did that. And they want to start just not evaluating on water quality, but looking at stormwater capture to address some, which they should be doing. I was horrified that they weren't. I mean, here we are trying to get this so we have recharge to our basin, and it's not even a priority to look at that. So anyway, I thought it was the person from flood control and several members that are actually on the committee are interested in that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your written report and your verbal report. And I want to go back a second. I don't think I said thank you to Mr. Albiani and Mr. Molina for your written reports and your verbal reports. So I just want to say thank you to them because I missed that. I apologize.
Yeah, we just jumped off really fast.
I just have one question. Towards the end of your report, you explained that there was a public hearing held to approve a pre-annexation agreement and open space management agreement for the Chisaro Phase 2 project, and that the city agreed to participate in the BOLD program through CMFA to facilitate a CFD. The question that sparked in my mind when I read that was, is this the same group who came to us for a CFD? Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So does that mean they're going to come back to us, or this is it? They found someone else to do it?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Water facilities will not be part of it, but they pursued the city for other facilities that they're responsible for paying for. So
okay.
Same kind of overarching program that the board heard a few different times, right? But yeah, yes, the developer to the city, and the city adopted that.
Okay.
And the city, I mean, the county adopted $70 million for New Hall.
That's correct. Thank you. I'm glad they didn't come to us for 7 minutes. I just want to say, Hunt, over the years, your reports are getting better and better. Thank you for that.
You know, it's the increased age. That's all. Only excuse and explanation I can have. That's what happens when you become more mature. That's what I tell myself.
Okay. You've been busy, and I appreciate all the work you're doing. And the report is succinct, and it's comprehensive, and it's wonderful. Thank you.
Mr. Brawley, in case I missed it, I don't think I did, any comment on the city's involvement in the old senior center, and also any updates on our park?
I didn't hear the last part of your question. I heard the senior center.
Our park?
Nothing recent. Understand that both of those facilities are owned by the County of Los Angeles. There is a joint program between the board office, the county, and the city to take the old senior center on Market Street and do some veterans arts programs and some other things. And that's an in-process project. It was mentioned when Supervisor Barger was out here with the joint meeting with the members of the council. The same with Hart Park. My understanding is they are looking into and trying to ensure a pathway to go back to the probate court, because the probate specifically gave, or the will specifically gave the property to LA County. Of course, it wasn't a city back then. And so there has to be a process for the probate court to confirm or affirm that this can be done. The parties want to do it, but whether they've got to go through that legal process, I'll see if there's an update for our next meeting, but I haven't heard anything for the last couple of months.
Okay, thank you. So moving on to item four, presented by Kathy Martin, discussion on the legislative advocacy contract renewals.
Thank you. Yes, this is that time again for us to review the proposals from our three legislative advocates and consider another two-year renewal of their contracts. Last time we did this was when we went to 2 years. Prior to that, it was on a one-year cycle. But 2 years definitely provides a little bit more consistency and stability for us to work through long-term projects. So we have asked each of the consultants to submit a proposal, which is included in your packet. These aren't the actual, Steve noted for me, I had missed this. These aren't the actual contracts that we would sign. And one of the things that we've talked about in this group before is that we do have a 30-day clause from either side if the contract needed to be ended for any reason sooner than that 2 years. So that would be the final one that is signed. You can see on the front page of that item, it is a summary of the fees for each one, VSA and Paul Jaffrey, the same. CalAd has requested a 10% increase, understandably so, as Dennis is now serving on the Aqua State Legislative Committee at our behalf, which is quite a big lift for him and quite a few more hours spent doing that work specifically. And I think we can all agree, just if nothing else, based on the growing length of these meetings, that our legislative advocacy program has just really ramped up in the last couple of years. It is a long game. It's not something that there's necessarily an outcome every month, but there are just some great projects in the works and some great opportunities for funding coming down the pike. And as Steve always uses the fishing analogy, you know, we have to get our lines in the bucket in order to have those opportunities. And we definitely have been casting some lines out there. So in the proposals, they each talked about what their main accomplishments have been over the last couple of years, but I pulled out a couple of highlights in this, the agenda cover sheet. I won't read through them. They're right there in front of you, but we feel like all have provided a lot of value, and staff at this time recommends continuing the contracts as they're presented here. Do we have any discussion or answer questions?
We have no public comment card. Do we have any comments online?
No, we do not.
Directors?
Can we discuss it without the
consultants?
So we asked them to participate, but if it's the committee's preference, we can they can sign off.
Before they do, I'd like to ask Dennis. Basically, it's a 10% increase, and is that mostly to cover your attendance at the legislative Aqua Legislative Committee, or is there other? Is there something else that's part of that 10% increase? Thank you for unmuting. And you don't have to be, you don't have to use the link if you don't want.
It's definitely not for my technical capabilities, let me tell you that. And I think there's some time that just, you know, we run a business and everything's getting more expensive. So we have brought on Anthony, and he spends a significant amount of time here and more as well, and both of us. So I think there is some additional response. We've been, you know, frankly, a few years back, you know, we were doing the merger and all that stuff. We weren't as focused on trying to get money. And we've been working with the staff and everybody to figure out, you know, and frankly, board members, here's how you get money and here's what we need to do and, you know, getting projects. And so I think that the overall activity has increased too. And then, you know, costs have gone up as well. So the combination of those three things.
Okay, I'm looking at the write-up from Vance Koyak, and I would just say it would have been easier for me had you said we invested, and I will tell you straight up, Jeff and Hunt, thank you for not upping your fees. That's appreciated in the new proposal. At least that's what I'm seeing. You haven't upped your fees. And it would have been real clean and an easy decision for me to say, let's do this. If your reports had said our work resulted in X million dollars in grant funding, so your return on investment was X. I mean, I look at $280,000 a year over 4 years, $1.1 million. All you needed to say to me is our efforts have netted $4 million in grant funding.
So I'll help out.
Okay, help me because I'm almost there.
I must know you too well because I did the math.
Okay,
when I got in here tonight. Okay. I thought this question may be coming.
Okay.
So the first thing I'll say is one, I appreciate the full advocacy team's work because it has been a major effort over these last 2 years.
And agreed.
I think, as you know, Kathy was mentioning too, this is a long game, right?
Yes.
And we're not in this for the short term. We're in it to have a good advocacy program that we're going to have, hopefully, access to funding for multiple funding cycles.
Mm-hmm.
So with that context, you know, we work as a team, and this is staff and kind of the local, state, and federal advocacy group. Obviously, Cheryl Fowler is playing a key role in that now as the one that's actually getting, you know, pen to paper.
Yep.
And getting these grants submitted. But, you know, between the last 2 years, when I add up, and this is in your package tonight too, in the summary table that Cheryl provides at the end, but when you look at the grants that we've received, I'm at right at $20 million over the last 2 years.
So over the last 2 years.
And that gives you an idea on kind of the investments that we're making and just specifically on the funding cycle, the kind of funds that we're trying to bring into the agency. So that is a huge deal. I think we've set up a lot of longer-term plays that are going to start to show their access, as well as some of those that Jeff mentioned earlier through appropriations, Army Corps access, and those types of things. So I'm extremely happy with the return that we've seen in the last 2 years.
It's almost 36-1.
And
that's really
good. And that's just, you know, that's a part of what they do, right? There's a whole different side to the advocacy on the bills and those things that we're trying to make sure that the agency is having their voice heard and our interests protected. So that's my roundup of that.
And there's a whole bunch of intangible benefits that we haven't talked about. Knowing the director of Fish and Wildlife, for example, those types of things, gentlemen, are so helpful. And that's part of the long game. It's who you know sometimes. So thank you for all your efforts. And thank you for improving the quality of these reports. They're still a little too thick for me, but I'm all right with that. At $36 net back from your efforts per dollar we invest, you're doing a great job. Keep it up. Thank you.
I think it's important to know also that we didn't just hire them as grant money and everything else. We hired them for their knowledge, their expertise, their communication. And so the value, you know, where do you put a dollar value on that? You know, looking back at the whole thing, you know, we started this program 10 years ago with getting virtually nothing. We expanded with the new organizations and some new guidelines, and it's been very helpful and very productive to us. And I hope that it continues going in that direction. for us to just look at the monetary side, it's extremely important, but also looking at the knowledge side. And I think staff has had a tremendous amount of learning experience with them. And I think that that's something that's a very much a plus also.
Yeah.
Any other committee chairs, any other committees comments?
Hats off, men. Thank you.
I do have a
couple. You had one question? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
List them here. Like, you have questions?
That's fine. Yeah. So my first question is, I noticed the timeline slightly different for VSA compared to the other two. So what, they have an October start date for theirs and the other two are July. We can't align those. There's no way to do that.
If you look at the expiration dates, they do all align this time.
Okay.
Because of the last time we did this process, the federal advocate took a little bit longer in the process and where it was in the board.
Okay.
But we've asked them to technically do short of a 2-year contract so that we can get them back in the line.
Great, thanks. And then I don't know the history. How were these three groups selected initially? If you could share that with me.
Yeah, so sure, we can do that. So there was... And let's see how far back I want to start. But so as interim chair, Kelly, was describing, so there was kind of a history of the legacy agencies and advocacy representation. So former Newhall County Water District had advocacy representation. Castaic had advocacy representation. Newhall basically did the one-stop shop type approach with an advocate. Castaic, the former Castaic Lake Water Agency, had federal advocate, local, which was Hunt still at that time, and then a state advocate, which was Dennis. The federal advocate was a different. And so when we got kind of the new agency together, we decided to streamline kind of the advocacy contracts because we had kind of all those coming into one. And so we went through a process. At that time, the board wanted to look at the potential of a new federal advocate. We went through a very thorough process of interviewing and ultimately selection of Jeff Spurn, Van Skoyak through that process.
It was an RFP where we solicited proposals. I think we interviewed five agencies.
We had interview series. We did a whole actually thorough vetting of a number of firms, and Jeff's firm was our best choice, and I think we made the right decision.
And then also, excuse me.
That orange drink's really good.
It's the almond shard that I'm choking on. And then for the state advocacy, we ended up streamlining down to one, and that was Dennis's firm. And I think at that point in time, the new board felt that, you know, Dennis's experience and his knowledge, as Director Kelly was pointing out, was probably going to be best suited for the new agency going forward. And so that selection was made. It was very similar with kind of local representation.
I think what's important, at least through my comment, is that when we went through the merger and looked at all the different avenues, we as a board really sat down and seriously looked at the different individuals representing us and what they were offering, and made different requests of them, gave them different demands. They came back with new ideas, fresh ideas. So when it comes to Poole & Shapiro, you know, we felt that they had more to offer. They've stepped up. When it came to Dennis Saviani, the same thing. We wanted more detailed information. We've been getting it. And the past representative we had on a federal level was an excellent person, but he was somebody that was with us for a long time. There was like a lot of loyalty there, but we didn't rock the boat. That individual wasn't contributing dollars, just information. And so we went out and made what we considered the best choice at the time to get our commitment on both the financial side and on the information side. And that's worked out very well.
Okay.
So I think that's the best way I can add on to what Steve had to say. So,
I mean, I appreciate that, because one of the things I was thinking about is, well, do we want to do a periodic RFP process, bidding process? Because, I mean, I feel like, you know, we're happy with what we have, but I think it's still good. It keeps everybody on their toes if we do open it up to RFP every 2 year cycle. And if, you know, we're happy with the work that we're receiving and we're getting really good returns, I think the choice will be clear at the end of the day. But I think it's offers the public, it shows the public that we're not just, you know, giving contracts to our friends. You know, people really have to work for it. And if they're giving us good product, then there's, you know, there's reasons why we continue to use them. So I would like to see an RFP process put at the end of the contracts, and then we reevaluate every 2 years.
So we are we ending the second 2 year contract or the third? Ending with federal.
The first 2 year contract. We're ending the first 2 year contract. Is how I would say that. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Yeah, we were.
And part of that contract obviously was during COVID, and we were still able to communicate and generate grants and other types of money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dr. Amitai, part of the process, we do have the ability to go to RFP, VP, or we have the ability to recommend status quo based on success. I can say that we stayed with the accounting firm, the auditors, for many years because they did an excellent job. We weren't really looking for change. We got what we were trying to get out of it. But eventually it became a strong point that it was time to go RFP. And at any time this committee wants to go out on RFP, all you need to do is make a recommendation, we'll discuss it, and move forward from there. So as of right now, I believe we're not going out to RFP. We're looking at renewing based on the contracts that are here and any increases. Is that correct?
That's the recommendation, yeah, from staff. I think, yeah, from our point, it's, you know, we're fortunate to have, you know, this committee in this environment, right, that we can get the feedback from our advocates. And, you know, it's kind of a measurement along the way, right? If you know, the committee's feeling that they're not getting information, you can give that feedback directly. And I think we've been doing that as a committee. And so from our standpoint, you know, looking at the costs, I think, California Advocates has asked for what I would consider a reasonable increase given the circumstances. Another two have held, you know, their prices. I would suspect if we go back out, and when we did this on the federal side,
things went up.
Yeah.
Things were quite a bit up. And I would say that prices have not gone down since that point in time at all. But, you know, to your point, I think it is good to check in every once in a while if that's what the committee's feeling. But I think it is a bigger, you know, evaluation. If you're happy with the service, if the price is reasonable, then, you know, I think that's a decision that can be made as well.
And I just want to be clear. I wasn't suggesting we do the RFP now. It was at the end of the next cycle is what I was thinking.
It's an appropriate step if for any reason you have a concern. I would agree. I think you're right. The returns are impressive, and the performance and the quality of the reports remains high. If any of that falls off, we certainly should consider it, because that's the way we're supposed to behave as board members and as advocates of the public. So
yeah, and no directors or committee persons request is turned down. So if it comes up to where on some issue you want to go out, or you want to go out to RFP, or Director Planbeck wants to go out, you bring up a conversation and you know, we'll go from there. I do have a couple of questions. I probably Kathy's the first on the first one. I'm assuming this 284 is covered in our budget.
Yes, we have a budget of $350,000 for advocacy efforts. So that extra would include if we've always intended to make an annual trip back to DC ourselves, and some other travel on the boat.
Dennis and everybody had their earmuffs on when you said 350. You know?
Okay. Yeah.
Making sure. Also, under it says there's an asterisk. Each proposal includes incidentals and expenses up to 12.8. That's 12.8 per annum.
Yes.
And does the travel, is that included in the 12-8 or is that outside of it?
That's outside.
Okay. But the 12-8 per individual or per group as well as travel is all part of the budget of the 350.
It is. And I should point out too that 12-8 is in their current contracts. And I think we expend, I think they claimed about 1,200 of that this year combined. It rarely gets used, at least during COVID.
All right, good. Any additional questions, Dr. Plavina?
Yeah, I have one for Hunt, and that's how many of your folks in the Valley do you represent? And are they agencies or are they developers or what?
You mean clients? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
Director Flambeau.
Probably you do this for a lot of people, right?
Well, this is the only public agency that I do work for. I do represent the private sector, and as I think you know well, I do represent both in the county and the city some development entitlement projects. However, all those projects have a very clear understanding. We did this years ago with Dan Masnada, who was the general manager, that we provide no advice and no involvement with any issues they may or may not have with the water agency. So we don't advise or provide any input or represent them with the water agency.
Very good. So
send it to the board.
We're looking at.
I would like to discuss this without the.
Say it again.
I would like to discuss this without the consultants present.
Okay. So, consultants, would you click off and we're going to have a quick private conversation?
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dennis couldn't get on and now he can't get on.
Yeah, exactly. Hang on, I'm on my wife's phone, so I'm
all right. So yeah, this increase isn't his technical prowess.
Okay, he's done.
Okay.
Well, I think I've mentioned before that I'm really concerned about Hunt's representation of developers and then representation of us, because sometimes, I mean, when one person is doing both, I think it can be confusing to the public and it can be confusing to the, and you know, we don't really have that with Jeff, because of course he's out of town, and I think they're absolutely excellent anyway. I would never want them to go away at this point anyway. I think they do a really good job. And I feel the same way about Dennis, except I'm really concerned about, he's our rep on the Ledge Committee at Aqua, and then he's our advocate. And then I feel like, I don't know, I feel like there's so much that there's just not room for give and take so much there, that he's also representing a lot of different people. And I Dennis, and that's fine too, but I'm really worried about Hunt. And I just want to say that because it's local, it's really close, it's folks that we are around all the time. And I've seen some interactions with city council, which I know I mentioned to you, that were not really appropriate. And then if he has to come and advocate for us, that can, I mean, it's the same person. So, you know, I just really am. I'm wondering if there is anybody else in town that does that. Is Jeff Hacker doing this?
Jeff Hacker moved out of town.
Did he? Because I know he's still talking to people.
Yeah. He packed up his, my understanding is he packed up his life and moved out of town.
Oh, really? Okay. When did he do that? Recently?
It was about a month ago is when I started hearing conversations about it.
Oh, I had no idea. Well, I don't know. I'm just wondering if there's anyone else. That's all. And I don't know. Maybe there's not another person that we could have for local events.
Well, we do have a, what was it, 30-day clause, 60-day clause to get out of any contract. So if we do vote on it tonight and we want to go out and do some discovery work, we can always give notice and get out of the full chapter contract.
Well, does anybody else have concerns about that besides me?
I personally don't, but I think there's a certain amount of integrity that goes on with Hunt and all the representation that he has in town. But that's my view. You may have a different view on it.
Well, I mean, I just was upset because I heard this interaction with the city council. And I don't know, when you have a bad interaction, it wasn't on behalf of us. It was on behalf of actually, it was the Sand Canyon guy, that Kim guy. And
I was representing him, the Sand Canyon Country Club.
Right. And it was rather an aggressive action. And then I don't understand how a person separates that. I mean, if I were a council person and someone was aggressive with me on something and I felt it was uncalled for, and then he wants to lobby for me on something on the water agency, do you really separate that out, or do you have the same feelings about him when he's there? I think you have the same feelings. I mean, he may be there talking about one thing on behalf of one person and then another thing on behalf of water agency, but he's the same person. So that's my concern, and that interaction was really not good. And I feel like if we want to have good relations with the city, it's important to make sure that our advocate is not representing developers or not presenting himself in an aggressive manner. That's my concern.
I would ask Steve and Kathy, Is there been any reports, or is there any ill will between the city and Santa Cruz Valley Water Agency because of Hunt?
No, I haven't heard anything.
I don't know how you would hear that anyway.
I think if there were a voiced concern on the part of staff or on the part of the city with Santa Cruz Valley Water, I'd have a concern. But I think Director Kelly's right. Hunt manages his affairs in such a way that there's an integrity represented and demonstrated, and I don't perceive any problem.
Well, nobody's going to come to the water agency and say, "Hey, we don't like your advocate." I don't see why they would do that.
If there was a problem, the city would approach us. I really think if there was a problem, if the city was completely put off, and from what I understand, Hunt failed miserably with the Country Club. He didn't represent them well enough to get their project approved. That's my understanding.
He was asking the city to do stuff. He wanted to not have an evacuation. The city wasn't going there, so it wasn't like he didn't represent them well enough.
This is something that normally would go on the consent calendar, but because of your questions, do you want it to go on consent?
I don't know. If no one has a concern but me, I don't, then maybe not. I mean, I'm not going to pull it off of consent, probably. I think I won't vote for it, but I'll just keep my mouth shut.
And that's the nice thing about what we have on this board, is we have those rights to agree, disagree, vote. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate every time you don't vote, because I know that you've got a solid reason why. And there's different times I don't vote on things because I feel like there's a little earmark in there that I don't like, and regretfully, you're not given the choice of taking that out when you vote. So you either got to vote for it all or vote for none of it. Mm-hmm. So I agree. It's a tough call sometimes. Director Armitage?
So I don't know the history as well as Director Planbeck does, but I hear her concerns and they sound valid to me. So I will say that I share that. Separately, I have expressed in the past disappointment in not really seeing an effort at working with the city and the county when the pandemic relief funds were being distributed. I would ask about it at the meetings, and I felt like I did not see any work being done there. I didn't see the evidence of work being done. I didn't see any communication being put out by the city or the county that showed that there was an effort and collaboration done with them to get the word out to people that these funds were available. And so I know I expressed that in the past, so I'll just raise that again here one more time. And I that is probably one contract that I would like to see
go out
to bid sooner.
And Mr. Atkins noted that his reports were better, but they were better because of, I think, Director Armitage's really going after him.
Well, I think that we all really hammered it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were not acceptable.
Yeah. He was coming in with a report from, 2 months ago.
Yeah. Saying, oh, right. And it was just one liners. Right. So it's much more detailed now.
Yeah. But we've really jumped, and staff, I think, has jumped on his case about making sure we get better representation.
No, I don't like to have to jump on people's cases. I mean, why aren't we, as an advocate, we should be providing aid. Report, we shouldn't have to be telling them. And
well, he's doing a better job now.
I would think maybe I can offer a little bit more input here. Committee wants to recommend with funds contracts, fine. But one thing I would, there's a couple different ways you can do local advocacy, right? And there's examples all over in our local community where you have like the city, they have a staff member that does advocacy, right? Couple staff members that's what they do. And, I'd like to see this package still, as it's recommended, go forward the way it is. But, if we want to explore different options, I would definitely like that to be one of the options.
I would love to see
exactly
that.
Yeah. Getting a dedicated staff member that is focused on our advocacy program. Because right now, Kathy and I do it, but we're not focused on it. I'll tell you that right now. There's too many other things in our, responsibilities that we do what we can, but we're really relying on our professionals to make sure that they're hitting on all cylinders. So that example of, as an organization of our size and dedicating somebody that's going to focus on these efforts is something that I would be really interested in seeing this agency consider.
Yeah, maybe we could put it in as part of the outreach budget, because I think that having someone from the agency that goes and sits in the city council meetings and is able there to answer their questions or whatever, and can bring back the notes from, as Hunt does, I think that would be a better situation. It would probably be a more expensive situation. But I do think it would be helpful, because I think that the liaison between the two agencies, I think it would be helpful to be able to work more closely with the city. I don't know how you feel. Everything's going hunky-dory with them, but sometimes I feel like we're two different entities in the silos. And there's so many things we should be working together on, like drought messaging, and maybe you're doing that, and I don't know about it. So,
so are these contracts intended to start on July 1? So in hearing everybody, including staff, I might recommend that we move these forward to be voted on as is. There is an acceptance already by Steve, that he'd like to get it moved. I wouldn't like to see any gaps, but I would also, in accordance with your concerns and your concerns, I'd like to address staff to come back to the next meeting and answer Director Plambeck's question. Is there anybody else in this valley, that could do the job and could replace, Schaefer? And come back and at least report on that, but also have some direction to maybe come up over the next couple of months based on your time permitting and address Steve's concerns about the possibility. And it sounds like that into the table, all three of you have the same type of concern of possibly addressing the possibility of bringing somebody in-house, what the cost would be, and things of that nature. And that's not something that's going to be handed overnight.
Yeah.
So, but addressing both concerns, I think, is important.
Yeah.
And Director Plambeck's concern can be addressed fairly easy, because I don't think there's a replacement team here. So that might force it to fall on the budget and come back with somebody in-house.
Yeah, we'd be happy to make that both those assignments.
We'd probably be triple what we pay Hunt putting somebody in house. But that's a, you know, that's, if that's what staff says, then that's what staff says.
Right, but it, maybe if you're not, maybe you don't have to hire somebody full time.
Maybe. That's because a good director, I think.
You're essentially paying what you pay a part-time person anyway, except for
so the general manager's probably pulling his hair out. I know he's very silent. Do you want to step in on any of this?
Sure. Yeah. Why not? No. It's been a good discussion. We've had that same discussion about Hunt, and I think there's a side of Hunt that's valuable just because of his long time in the Valley and his relationships. And I was impressed the first time I met him, and we had some interactions with, I'm trying to remember. It was a former legislator, but they went way back, and they were on, you know, opposite sides of the political aisle, but they had a very good, cordial, kind of fun relationship. I do think, though, that, you know, one of the thoughts in kind of developing the agency's capabilities over time is just, it might be appropriate to, you know, work towards having an intergovernmental relations staff person. And that person could be doing, you know, maybe some broader tasks of general communication. It's a trade-off. You don't necessarily get that level of relationship, but you can build it over time. I think of Mike Murphy, who was with the city for quite some time and became, you know, a very credible kind of go-to person on things. And often he would be the person at the city who would call me to give me a heads up when something was going on that I needed to know about, you know, if it didn't already get to me through our staff in some way. So, I mean, I could see over time looking for a transition in that function to more of an in-house function.
Okay. So we're going to go ahead and move this forward, consent calendar, and then staff's got his directions. Okay.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. So item 5.
Yeah. I'll keep this really short. This in light of our time. Got a short PowerPoint. This originated from a question, I think, from maybe Director Cooper originally at a board meeting about what exactly we were using as our guide for our drop communication. So just want to give you a high-level overview of that. We have two guiding documents that we use. One is the Water Shortage Contingency Plan, Section 5, includes a communications plan. It's broken down by stage. So stage 1, here's our communication goals, here's the audiences, here's what we'll do, all the way through stage 6. And we also have a more in-depth draft communications plan that is our consultant Rachel from RMG Communications helped us develop this when we brought her on to help. It's got 3 main goals that are shown. Three main goals that are shown here: raising awareness, motivating behavior change, and looking at water policy and shaping water policy and development around drought and water supply issues. That communications plan is very robust. It has 3 main goals. It has strategies and tactics for each of those. It drills down into the audience. It also has a whole section that's just key messages. These are the main messages that we are putting out around all of these topics so that no matter what kind of collateral we're creating, we're using the same language. And what's important to know about these, though, is they are definitely living documents. So every time we message about something and we get feedback, we go back and revise these and update these or as other situations change.
So is that something that's been presented to the board before? This whole...
No.
Because I'd be really interested in
this. I mean, the contingency plan, that was part
of it. Right. I know about the contingency plan.
Not
the communications goals or the draw communications
plan. We make a communications plan for almost any major effort. Urban water management plan, PFAS, either internally or with our consultants. That's the first thing that we do is create a communications plan. So we have something to go back to all the time and remind us what we're really going to do.
I have a question before you go to the next slide. the goal three, is that targeted to like the board members?
Partly, but also through our advocacy and through staff, for example, Matt Dickens' participation in CalWeb and other entities. So as I was saying, we regularly review and update this. Customer feedback is a main one. So as we put out the messaging on stage two with water restrictions, customer care was getting a lot of calls on, but what about trees and what about this and what about that? So as you watch our collateral evolve, the next round had a lot of information about exemptions. I'll tell you a little bit more about that on the share piece that's coming up next. If we find that something that we are messaging about is creating questions or confusion, it's easy for us to adapt. So customer care tracks those calls and conservation as well. We have a team of conservation communications that meets every other week just to talk about these issues. And we have another meeting weekly with my team and Rachel that is just drought and website questions. We have a monthly meeting that is with, we call it the SWAT team. And that city is, oh, I think it's on a later slide. Anyway, city, county, multiple agencies, and we meet monthly on these things. There's a lot of collaboration going on. But the important part here is just that we do review and refine and adjust as we need to as we go along. Next. I'll actually go back. This is one. Yeah, so customer care, we talked about SWAT. With Sustainable Water Action Team.
Matt Dickens. That's a Matt Dickens thing. He's the acronym king. Oh my god.
That's like county, public works, the city of like people from six or seven different departments in the city. It's a big group where we share, here's the latest regulations, here's what we need you to do. We share material like the Seasons magazine that's coming out, that's the city's quarterly recreation and city newsletter. There's a whole page on drought. That's the material we provide them. It's a lot of great partnerships there.
So when you bring this to the board, you'll have to bring fly swatters so they can swat her.
Swat, yes. So then just a quick overview of the types of things we've been doing. So from the beginning, we created the logo and all that that entails. You know, there's a lot of thought goes into our branding. So we wanted to create a sub-brand that's still recognizable as SCB Water. We've shared this logo with other agencies. We have social media posts and different things that we provide them that they can just post. They can share ours. They can brand it with their own logo and add to it. Next, please.
I like that you kept the fundamental teardrop logo as part of it.
Yeah, I like that too.
Yeah, that was Rachel's work too. So talking about audiences, we've done most of our outreach, of course, has been direct to our customers. We have our e-newsletters, which we have about 20,000 on the email list. So it's not all of our customers. But those e-newsletters get opened by 25 to almost 40% when we send those out. And that is just unheard of, even in a government industry.
Yeah.
We get a lot of attraction on those. We have done two or three now direct mail pieces, actually hard copied to their mailboxes. We always can tell when one of those hits because there is a flood of phone calls afterwards. A whole bunch of different various print collateral from fact sheets and flyers and door hangers and program cards and a lot of things. We've had booths at several community events, the big one at the Home Garden Show, but we've also been present at several. Most recently, Casey was out there Sunday at the city's new event. It was a little music festival. I can't remember what it was called. Music for All.
Free to be me.
Yeah,
something
like that one. Yes, yeah, so we had a booth out there at that city event.
Yeah.
We've done a couple of drought surveys. We have the Paseo banners that come up now and then, and then of course the virtual drought forum was well attended. Next,
we still drought forum online still.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So droughtready.scb.com. There's a link to it where you can watch the recording. We still do a lot of print media. The Signal, while their distribution has decreased considerably through the years, there are still a lot of people that get their news that way. And so we have quite a few big, colorful print ads that run regularly. We're in the Sunday Signal almost every week, which has a larger distribution. That one goes to non-subscribers. And we have monthly ads in the two main magazines locally. Next, please. We also have really gone heavy in digital radio and video. We have done a program with iHeartMedia. We have Spectrum and The Signal and KHTS, where our digital ads just appear everywhere. If you spend any time online, I would expect that they are popping up for you as well. We've done a couple of videos that run pre-roll on, if you're watching a video on YouTube or something, it will pop up. And of course, tons of social media. Okay, next. And then we've got some media relations between Matt Dickens and Laura, our public affairs specialist too. We've had a couple of different TV news appearances. We've been on SCD TV Community Corner twice, and we're booked again for August. If you look at the last main bullet point, earned media reach, there's a resource that Rachel subscribes to called Critical Mention Report, and it just scans. You know, we get Google alerts for where we appear, but this Critical Mention is kind of an AI thing where it just scans everywhere you're mentioned, what comments come under, what the tenor of those comments are. And so across everything that we have done, I think that one's since January, we've had an estimated local TV audience of about 327,000 and an online print audience of 13 million up. And so if we had paid for those types of views, that would be the value of that type of outreach that we've had.
How do you get to the 329,000K in publicity and 1.1 million in public? How do you get to that?
That Critical Mention Report, I could send you a link to their dashboard, but it estimates what the audience is that you've had just based on where you've been seen and how many people are watching or looking at that. And if we had had to pay to be placed that way, or these are ones that we didn't pay for.
Okay.
We
have paid. So the competition, the market rate for getting eyes on that.
Yeah, this is just like because we're on these TV stations and lots of people see those and they get reposted and shared.
Right,
it's like earned media.
Yeah.
As opposed to purchased media. A lot of stakeholder outreach we do. I talked about SWAP, but all of these different groups listed on here have had presentations from a staff member, a board member on a regular basis. We've done some presentations at statewide conferences. Matt Dickens is at that last one right now, American Water Works Association Annual Conference and Expo. And he's a very recognized expert in conservation and water use efficiency and frequently called to speak at state and national conferences. Next, please. We have pretty much everything that we create is being translated to Spanish. Some directly where it's a two-sided thing, English and Spanish. Sometimes there'll be a section of it in Spanish with a link to get additional information online. But the ones that are critical, especially, we just do full Spanish translation.
So the bulletin's online on the website. We have the ability to change the languages by a punch of the button. So in other words, we have a huge Vietnamese contingency up here, Korean contingency, anything like that, where we have a program that translates it.
We pretty much any web browser, somebody that speaks that language knows how to do that. Our website doesn't make that seamless right now. Our new website, which is very, very, very close, makes that easier. There is a drop down menu on the top of every page that says English, has the arrow, and you can drop down, and the I think 12 main languages here are all represented. So it will get much easier here in 46 weeks when we launch the new website. So what's next? I mentioned those two on the right is part of SCD Community Pride, a special publication that the Signal does. We bought a 4-page insert. So that's full newspaper page size. And this is the one where we brought in the top tips to care for trees. We have a whole section on exemptions, efficient irrigation practices, just trying to make it just colorful and segmented and easy to scan and pick out the parts that you want. There's two more pages in that.
Positive.
Yes. but still having here are your watering requirements and here are your watering restrictions.
Right. Okay.
Then another piece that we're really excited about is this one over here, Garden Smart. That is a Sacramento area publication that was done through this company, NNR Publications. And we are doing something similar here. So it'll be Garden Smart SCV. The company is amazing. It's all veteran journalists and storytellers. And we've had our storyboarding with them already and identify what the topics are that we want to cover in this publication. But there are things about like veggie gardening and lawn replacement and watering with clay soil. And it's all very specific to Santa Clarita Valley. There's a whole section on native plants and I can't remember.
I do want to clarify, since you brought that up, we're not going to pay for people to put in artificial turf.
No. The lawn replacement program, you can have artificial turf as part of a bigger project, but you don't get a rebate for that, and it can only be a certain percentage of the overall project. It used to be it wasn't, if you had that at all, it wasn't covered. So the new one allows some bits of it, but you're not, there's no rebate given for it. And this publication doesn't talk about artificial turf. It talks about our lawn replacement.
We would have something about bad artificial turf. And the reasons why you might want not want to choose artificial turf.
I hear them talk about that on the phone when people call. And anyway, so that Garden Smart one is in progress. It'll probably still be another 8 weeks. And it's also being done in conjunction with the Green Thumb Nurseries. Mm-hmm. So one of the articles is interviewing one of the higher-ups at Green Thumb. And they're also going to help with distribution where they'll be placed at the nurseries. And you'll be able to point people to the plants that are talked about and recommended for the area. And that's just like a quick snippet of it. Drought is takes up a huge chunk of our time and effort. We've got a team that's working on it, and it is ever changing. You know, we're constantly adapting to whatever the newest guidelines and stages and state restrictions, and as well as the community sentiment.
So where do you see this going? You want to take this to the board as a 5-minute, 10-minute presentation? You just bring it to the committee. You mentioned it. Director Cooper's one that had talked about it.
You know, he mentioned it and then a few others. So I don't know if it's something that needs to go to the board.
I think given that we're in stage two, you might want to bring it to the board and answer Director Cooper directly.
Okay.
And be prepared to do it again if we ramp up to stage three. So
I think everybody's going to love seeing the Garden Smart stuff.
Yeah.
That's so positive. It's such a positive way to present all these restrictions.
So maybe you can coordinate with President Martin and see which one of the agendas might be light enough to throw this in so we don't have 10 or 15 presentations all the same time.
Okay.
So it doesn't have to be at the next board meeting or the following one, but something within a reasonable time. And obviously the subject is its current time being drought and everything. So I'll leave it up to you to coordinate on when it can go to the board.
Okay.
And this is good. This is worth putting in front of the board members.
I need to go back real fast to Poole and Shaffrey. I made a note, I forgot to bring it up. But on item two of their scope of work, you know, we're a tri-county agency, even the devil's den, and shouldn't there actually be some monitoring for Kern County also? We've got Ventura, Los Angeles, and Kern County. I know every time I do my 700 report, I've got to include everything in Kern County too. So
let we can give that some thought. There's not much that happens up there. Not much. I hear your point. I hear your point. Let's give it some thought. Yeah.
All right. So if we're done with your slide presentation, and we can move on to item 6 and the Kathy Martin Show.
I had a couple comments and questions about pertaining to the slideshow.
I like when you raise your finger and say one. I mean, a couple comments.
Well, I only had a couple when I was preparing for the meeting, but I added a little bit based on your live presentation here. For the Garden Smart, is that something that's going to be published on a regular basis, or is that a one-time thing?
Right now it's a one-time. It's like tabloid size and 16 pages. It's pretty substantial.
Okay.
And the material is evergreen. We've kept away from, I think, a specific stage. So I know in Sacramento, talking to them, they have just been able to reprint it with little minor updates. So there hasn't been like a whole new issue of it, but they've.
Okay. One of the ideas I was thinking is if maybe you could feature local properties that have done nice examples of like lawn conversion, right, into drought-tolerant plants. I think that might be nice.
That is one of the features.
Good. Okay. And then I know you said you're going to have information about, is it Green Thumb, the nursery you mentioned. Can we also give some shout-outs to Theodore Payne Foundation for people who are looking for...
Yes, they are the second nearest resource.
Yes, awesome.
What we're doing right now is identifying potential interviewees for the different subject matter experts, and Theodore Payne is on our list.
Awesome. That's good to hear. Thank you. For social media outreach, I just wanted to mention that it seems to be that What's Up SCV is kind of the hip and new kind of what's latest source for people. So I don't know if we can establish a relationship with the people who run that to see if they'll maybe run some messaging for you guys. I don't know if that's possible, but that came to mind.
They will if we pay them.
Really? I know they want money, huh? Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. See, I don't know.
That's what's up.
I mean, they have the audience to demand that, but they do have them sponsorship opportunities.
Okay. Right? Yeah. See, I didn't know all the details. So I just see them and I thought, yeah, they're kind of in people's faces. So
it's in the budget under zero.
And then I just wanted to mention, it was interesting to me that the California Native Plant Society's publication, in the back, I started noticing that Helix Water District is placing ads, like a little 4x3x4 ad. And I'm wondering why. I'm like, why would they advertise in a native plant, California Native Plant publication? So I don't know the answer to that. Maybe there's some brilliance behind it. I'm not sure, but I just wanted to throw that out for maybe you can figure it out, and maybe it's not worth anything, but I just wanted to toss that out to you. Okay, so the couple of questions I had on my list previously was, I'm seeing a lot of people ask, in this time of drought, when we're asking residents to cut back, they're like, but I see the city watering their whatevers in the middle of the day. And, you know, that I see that a lot. I'm assuming the city is one of our biggest customers. And so my question is what conversations are we having with them, and what are strategies that they're using to kind of be that visible customer and example in our community of things that they're doing differently to conserve water?
I would be interested to know the specifics of what people are seeing. Be sure and have them let us know. We do have like somebody from the Lighting and Landscape District oversight from the city is on, as well as their Parks Department. And so I know we have spoken to them specifically about watering dates. And as a matter of fact, the last swap meeting, I remember them saying that they had, that was it, because they can do it on my computer, they adjusted all of their timers and watering dates and times.
Maybe they should make an announcement about that, because one thing that does, there's a couple of things that seem to enrage people. And one of them is when a sprinkler is going off and shooting. And I mean, I must have gotten that email 4 times. It's still going on. It's still going on. Why isn't anybody doing anything about it? And it's the same thing with the city when they have overflow or anything else. So I just think maybe we could be positive with them or something. And maybe if
we can do a post or a piece with them and us together, yeah. Right? Because we are. I mean, they are a huge component.
And they still are having overspray and stuff.
Anybody that manages sprinkler system, you're going to have that stuff, but they are trying to do a really good job. And the important piece is to make sure we try and get the feedback to the right person, right?
So right.
They can correct it if they have a broken sprinkler.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not saying go and beat them over the head. I'm saying let them know that this is happening, because it does somehow come back on us that a public agency is doing this. I think it's the same thing as was mentioned with fire department too. And so if we can work with the public agencies, so it appears that they're doing
we should do some outreach on it so the public understands that.
Yeah. And I'm always looking for those leaks because that's the only time I get my car washed.
Well, there was a bad one over on the window. We missed it.
And related, we have the communications that's needed with HOAs and non-functional turf, which the state has directed us to turn the sprinklers off for everybody. So we have some outreach that we are working on directly to working with the HOAs directly.
Are they all on separate irrigation meters for that stuff?
A lot of those are, but there will be some that are mixed, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's going to be a major effort. And so we're really trying to be strategic. We were talking about before about trying to make it an opportunity rather than calling out what everything by, right? It's
You can just tell them maybe some other stuff they could put in. This could be a really good opportunity to get birds and bees back. And people are really caring about that stuff. So I think that's why I like your Garden Smart so much. It's very nice. Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're moving on to witching. Let me finish my sentence.
Oh, okay.
Moving on to the witching hour of 2.5 hours, so we can come to a conclusion. Let's wrap it up.
Okay.
Ms. Armitage.
Thank you. This is my last one. So I know that some of our service area is actually LA County Waterworks Division, or some of the customers in Castaic and Valverde. My understanding is, from looking at the Waterworks Division website and briefly talking to Mr. Dickens a long time ago about this, is that their customers actually get routed to our rebate programs and conservation programs. But I feel like there's not very much knowledge about that in those parts of the community. So I do see LA County Waterworks, they put out tweets every once in a while about things, but I've never seen anything specific to like Castaic and Valverde. I see things going out to Malibu and things like that. So I'm wondering if there's some way we can collaborate also with them on their messaging to kind of mention some of the programs available for Valverde and Castaic area customers.
So Terry out there.
Yes, Terry Alex.
She attends our SWAT meetings every month.
Good.
And we actually had a meeting where it was just our outreach staff and her to further expand. And we've provided example posts and things for her to use out there. I don't know if she's been able to implement that, but we do have a relationship with her and try to assist her whenever we can.
Thank you.
Okay. We have any online public comments?
We do not.
Okay, the rest, I would just say, let me know if you have questions. This is the month where we have the quarterly social media report, which we had a nice jump in Facebook and Twitter followers based on a followers campaign that we did, a boosted campaign. And I'll come back next month with more information on page 3. It talks about a drought campaign, not a drop to waste. And those numbers are correct. 2 million in reach on social media and 16,000 engagements.
Wow.
This was part of the program, of the package of things we did through iHeartMedia. The total package cost was $40,000. The social media was one piece of it. But a lot of input. So engagement. What we hope for is that, because these kinds of things are hard to track, ROI, as Director Atkins is so keen on. We are hopeful and optimistic. The consumer's behavior is shifting and hoping that June, that seemed optimistic that June was going to show us a shift in our production numbers.
Well, we'll see. It'll be a good indication of it because it was hot. So we'll see if they're going to change.
And then just last thing, as we're always planning way ahead, planning for June of 2023, I want to let you guys know, you're the first to know outside of some staff, that I am planning my retirement for next year.
No.
So you have a full year. There's a lot going on. It gives us a lot of time to plan for a transition.
Sorry, refuse.
I've already said that.
Yeah.
No, it didn't work. Right.
At one point it was December, but I have extended that to
June.
But it's just getting talked about a little bit more, and I wanted to make sure we can get back to somebody on the board without hearing it from me directly. So not a decision I come by easily, but.
All right. So anything else? Well, move on to item 7, which is adjournment. Thank you for your patience. Good questions tonight. Thank you.